Hello, everyone. This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here today with Kerry Bolton, and we're going to be discussing his new book, Babel Inc., or Babel Incorporated, whichever way you prefer.
Thank you for having me on once again, Robert. It's always a pleasure.
What thing really inspired you to write this book?
Well, first I'll say that the title was suggested by Dr. Andrew Fraser in Australia. The original title was The New Babel, or Building the New Babel, and about 10 years ago I'd written a little pamphlet broadly on the subject, and like a lot of the things I'd done over the years, it was photocopied and received about half a dozen readers worldwide. And it's only in recent years, of course, that some wonderful publishing enterprises in the English language have come onto the scene, such as Black House Publishing and Arctos and Countercurrents, etc. So I reconsidered what was needed in a similar way I looked at why I wrote Revolution from Above, and that was basically to provide a one-stop resource on some of the broad issues.
Well, Revolution from Above was your first book, but the last book we talked about was primarily focused on the banking issue.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And of course, you know, they're all interrelated, and my view is that the banking issue and who controls the credit of a nation is, you know, one of the fundamentals of the problems that European culture faces, and you know, seems to be ironically one of the major issues that has largely been forgotten by the right. But certainly, as you'll see by Babel Incorporated, all these issues are very strongly interrelated, because it all comes down to a power grab by people who control the money and basically want the resources of the world to themselves. Babel Incorporated is basically another aspect of globalization, you know, and as the subtitle suggests, it's multiculturalism, globalization, and the New World Order.
So your first chapter is about capitalism, no color, no country, the nature of capitalism, and that basically just describes what capitalism is, which the right in the last 50 years has been the one who's been more in favor of capitalism, and primarily you get the funny thing is, like, leftists will kind of like to say, they'll actually say capitalism is racist even, but that basically is the main factor about capitalism is that it does not recognize nations, culture, or ethnicity.
Yes, that's precisely the premise of the book, and there's a rather interesting. Well, there's several rather interesting passages there from Noam Chomsky, and you know, I thought they were rather cogent, actually, where he says that capitalism is fundamentally anti-racist, and because they believe that humanity should be nothing but interchangeable cogs in the production and consumption process, and any boundary that interferes with that is to be opposed to.
Thinking of that the other day, I was in the Apple store at a major shopping mall in LA, and I was thinking how you had the majority of people there were members of ethnic minorities, but they were all there buying the same products at the Apple store.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. So long as, you know, that is the global marketplace, the global shopping mall, you know, and you know, differences basically, as Chomsky himself states, interfere with profit maximization and efficiency and mass marketing. So, you know, whether you call it conspiracy or coincidence, you know, the way capitalism has developed is simply that it needs a mass market that can be reliable, guided in certain directions, and, you know, even right down to what we wear, what we, you know, what we look at, eat, etc., so long as it can be marketed across the entire world without too many hindrances in terms of, you know, tradition and ethnicity or any other differences. So that's, you know, basically the what globalization is all about. And immigration and multiculturalism are major aspects of that. And of course, like a lot of crappy puerile issues that are taken up with enthusiasm, especially by the younger generations, you know, human rights and racial equality and multiculturalism are all heralded as wonderfully humane and, you know, the epitome of civic virtue. But once again, like catchphrases such as democracy, they're rather cynically used methods of breaking down identities in order to impose a what amounts to world slavery.
Yeah, I'm not sure the chapter it's from, but later in the book you talk about how these organizations like La Raza and MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund, are, you said that they were, one of them was funded by Walmart, and they're basically, most of them, they're backed by corporate interest.
Yes, that's towards the end of the book, where I, as in Revolution from Above, I provide specific details on how you know, a multiplicity of these fronts and organizations and lobbies are being funded by global corporatism and, you know, and the various foundations, etc. And MALDEF, you know, the Mexican American Legal Aid and Education Fund is one such organization. And, you know, I think Walmart, the backing that gives to MALDEF sort of epitomizes what's going on. You know, on the one hand, Walmart is known as an exploitive enterprise which treats its largely migrant staff, you know, virtually as wage slaves, basically. And on the other hand, it's expending vast amounts in public relations to fund these ostensible Latino civil rights organizations. And recently, Walmart was given a prize by a Latino advertising corporation as one of the great corporations of America. So, you know, there's a multi-layered strategy of why corporations back these various ethnic minorities.
I guess a good way to do it, I think we'll go by chapter. So the next,
certainly,
the chapter after that, the second major chapter, is decolonization as a prelude to globalization. And are you talking specifically about the sort of era right after World War II, when I got the end of the British Empire, for instance?
Yeah, basically, you know, the empires served a limited type of capitalism or business, and, you know, even then, you know, you had heroic figures like Cecil Rhodes and Clive of India, etc. So there's a bit of a dichotomy at work, especially in the British Empire, of, you know, capitalists and merchants and also adventurers and, you know, very heroic people. And I must admit I am a bit of a diehard imperialist. But, you know, the empires basically, well, the corporations and banking entities basically outgrew empires.
So the British Empire basically laid the infrastructure for globalization.
Well, basically, the way capitalism developed was that, you know, virtually outgrew the old empires. The empires did have a role to play in, you know, developing resources of the world for the European, but of course behind that all stood the City of London, etc., and the merchant bankers in Amsterdam. And so they came to a point, I'd say around the period of the First World War, when the empires were really hindrances rather than of benefit to the plutocrats. So they embarked on a new course of supplanting the old empires with a world order that would you know, completely destroy the old imperial ideas and divisions of the world. So, you know, one of the first manifestations of that was Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, which focused on international free trade. You know, and it obviously means that the world, First World War, was largely fought around, you know, the issue of world trade. Then, of course, the Atlantic Charter of 1941 between Roosevelt and Churchill underlies the same point, that the post-war world must eliminate empires in favour of free trade, and naturally Churchill sort of looked at and askance at Roosevelt and made the famous comments, you know, I believe he's trying to do away with the British Empire. And Roosevelt was in no bones that he considered all the empires the same as, Reichs, basically, and it was the revolutionary purpose of the USA to herald a new dawn over humanity in which a global world order would emerge. So after the Second World War, the USA was quite avid in attacking and undermining the old colonial states and destroying their empires. And, in that respect, it was virtually a revolutionary rival of the Soviet Union. So, both superpowers had a vested interest in destroying the old empires and filling the power vacuum, which is precisely what was achieved.
And you have a chapter on apartheid, and we touched on this in the last interview, apartheid, lest we forget, in parentheses, or never knew. And it's basically about how the apartheid regime in South Africa was in opposition to globalization, and how the powers that be they backed the movement to basically do away with apartheid and install the African National Congress.
Yes, precisely. And once again, Noam Chomsky, I cite him elsewhere in the book, also talking on anti-apartheid and how the anti-apartheid movement got rather good press from the corporate media. And once again, he states, well, this is because, apartheid was a hindrance to globalization.
But, and he's someone who's obviously who's very much against apartheid, but he still admits that.
Yeah. And, even when he's talking about civil rights, he says pretty much the same thing, but he also says, well, but that doesn't mean to say we shouldn't be against these things. And I think it's an example on Chomsky's part and, probably all other leftist intellectuals of, Orwellian doublethink. So, in regard to apartheid, the left conveniently forgets that that was basically, that emerged on a formal situation with the 1921 revolt on the Rand, when the white miners were opposing the monopolist attempts to undermine their conditions by importing cheap black labour. And the violence by which that was put down by the Smuts government resulted in a reaction which brought the nationalists to power in coalition with the Labour Party, and thereafter apartheid was gradually introduced until it was pretty much formalised by Verwoerd. But what you had with the nationalist Afrikaner economy was a system of parastatals, or state-owned corporations, and that meant that the nationalist government was a state interventionist government in terms of the economy, and of course that type of policy was went right against the free trade thinking. So the apartheid and Afrikaner regime had to be eliminated as yet one more obstacle to the global order.
The supposedly communist ANC has actually privatized basically the natural resources so the multinational corporations can exploit them.
Yeah, precisely. And recent newsletter put out by the ANC comments that privatisation is the correct Marxist-Leninist path, So, quite predictably, the ANC has pursued a policy of selling off the state-owned assets and privatising the economy. And, Nelson Mandela, of course, has also endorsed the policy. And if you look at the people who funded the anti-apartheid movement, and in particular the Progressive Party, well, the mainstay of that was the money of Harry Oppenheimer of the, Oppenheimer Mineral and Industrial Empire in South Africa, and he made no bones about his views that apartheid was a hindrance to developing a uniform market. So, you know, when it all comes down to what was behind the anti-apartheid rhetoric and all the, you know, supposedly idealist crap that was regurgitated by all these leftists, what it all boils down to once again is just working for a global capitalist economy. And interestingly, Helen Suzman, who was the sole MP for the Progressive Party in the South African Parliament for many years, and, you know, one of the heroines of the anti-apartheid movements, she started, once the apartheid regime was demolished, she started off up the Helen Suzman Foundation, and the aims of that are to introduce a free market economy. So, you know, you look back on all her anti-apartheid struggle and what was her ideal, a free market economy. And you look at the people who are on the board and fund the foundation, and they're all, you know, big, wealthy oligarchs, basically. So once again, you get back to what was the aim of all this, you know, all this jumping up and down against the Afrikaner, is just to sell the country out and grab the resources.
And the next chapter is One World, One Race. What do you mean specifically by the one race?
Well, that's the ideal. It seems to me it's the ideal of the corporate oligarchy, is to create a uniform humanity. You know, and I mean, one world, one race is basically a left-wing slogan that you hear quite often, but once again,
behind
that...
So you mean in a physical sense or in a cultural sense, or both?
Well, both, I'd say, in all senses, you know, spiritually, culturally, you know, every way possible, just have a nebulous mass of people that produce and consume. You know, and what their culture is just as disposable as a hamburger, basically, and I think that's the way the world is going and has been designed as such by these corporate oligarchs. But, you know, the book isn't really a treatise on the biological aspects of race. I mean, that's been debated many times before. It's basically a sociological and political look at why identities are under threat and why the maintenance of those identities are important. The concept of one world, one race, I mean, it's sort of the reverse image of the master race, you know, whereas Hitler was accused of wanting to create a purified Aryan race. Well, you could say, well, the corporate capitalists want, you know, something that's intended to serve their own interests, and that's just a nebulous mess.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who would be opposed to that, they would compare that to Nazis they would compare people like that to Nazis. But in a sense, they're doing a similar thing, and they're advocating destruction of whole peoples the same way that that Hitler did.
Yeah, well, supposedly did. I mean,
oh, okay.
Contentious. Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not a Nazi, but you know, it's once again a double standard.
And the next chapter is multiculturalism as a process of globalization.
Right. Well, specifically, have you got some specific questions in mind in regard to that? I'm just trying to...
Well, that's basically what the whole book is, but I guess what I'll ask you is give some specific examples of multicultural movements, of the intellectual aspects, and how they were funded by big global corporate interests.
Well, the most famous is the NAACP, which was the brainchild of Jacob Schiff, of, you know, the banker of the Wall Street Conlogan Company, and that was also funded by Herbert H. Lehman and Felix Warburg, and all these other, you know, notable names of international finance at the time. And Walter White Jr., the first director of the NAACP, even wondered whether it's good that the organisation is you know, funded so completely by these finances, and wondered whether it was just a means of controlling the policy. But in that respect, the funding has just kept going with the various foundations, etc. And
you know you know who Marcus Garvey is, the black nationalist. Basically, there was the judge who sentenced, who threw him in federal prison for like 5 years. Was actually a member of the NAACP.
So it was a matter of rival ideologies. Possibly.
And he wasn't. The judge wasn't black, of course.
Right. Yeah. But it sounds like people like Marcus Garvey, well, they threw basically a spanner in the works of what the internationalists wanted. I mean, you could say, I suppose, the same thing about the Nation of Islam. I'd say that the globalists want sort of their pet Negroes such as Martin Luther King, you know, who embraced the idea of, you know, we're all one, etc., whereas black separatists is just as, you know, abhorrent to the globalists as, you know, so-called white separatists.
Yeah, and it's primarily about economics, because what Marcus Garvey was doing is basically he was getting black people in Harlem to boycott white and Jewish-owned businesses, and having them, black people, be having their own self-sufficient economies.
Right.
Primarily about economics.
Yeah. That would certainly have thrown a spanner in the works for the whole system. And you know, as far as I know, that movement, I think, had the backing of was it Senator Bilbo?
Yeah.
Yeah, he started up a great Back to Africa movement with a lot of Negro support at the time. So, you know, it was a prime example of how people who are proud of their heritage and race, no matter whether they're black or white, can actually work together against a common enemy. And I think, you know, of course, that's very easy to forget when there's rioting in the streets and, you know, people are being forced upon each other who have completely different ways from each other. And, you know, multiculturalism does precisely the opposite of what it's supposed to. And it actually creates antagonism rather than goodwill. You know, we see it happening all the time, especially through Europe now. You know, and the way the Muslims are used are a prime example of the way the corporates use multiculturalism. You know, seeing that France, for instance, is the prime target.
You know what? You have the chapter target France. I think it would be, I'd like to do it sort of in chronological order, so it's a little bit easier for me to remember.
All right. Yeah, I'm just trying to remember the.
Yeah, we'll do it by chapter.
Yeah.
The next chapter is Global Me. I haven't gotten a chance to look over that chapter, but what do you mean by the Global Me?
Well, Global Me is actually a book that was written by Pascal G. Zachary, a Wall Street financial journalist some years ago, and I read this and found it quite fascinating about 15 years ago, and he said that hybridization of culture, corporations, individuals, executives and workers, etc., is a great benefit to international corporations. I mean, he said that the future of good business is to be hybridized, and I think he even referred to it as mongrel capitalism or hybrid capitalism. you know, because if an executive or you know, your staff or whatever is tied to a locale or has roots in a specific place, well, it's really quite an inconvenience if you want to transport your workers or your executives or planners to the other ends of the earth. If you want to shut down, you know, a plant in one country and ship it over to the third world, for instance, you want your workers to be so internationalized and that they can fit in, like, once again, like Chomsky said, like interchangeable cogs anywhere in the world. And Pascal Zachary said, well, basically, this is a wonderful thing and it's the wave of the future. And there have been, I've noticed, various other books that have come out in more recent years saying that multiculturalism and immigration, etc., are the great wave of the future for prosperity. So the idea is, once again, a global man or a global human without ties to any particular nation, culture, or ethnicity. Just basically his loyalty is to the corporation. And this theory was developed by Howard Perlmutter of the Wharton School of Business, who talked about geocentric companies, which means that companies should cease being tied to any particular nation and should be directed towards virtually anywhere, towards anywhere in the world. And he listed the obstacles for such geocentric companies as being nationalism and cultural differences. So basically what people such as Perlmutter and, other theorists of global capitalism are advocating is a sort of nomadic corporate executives and, nomadic workers who can be shifted about throughout the entire world. And the way to do this is, of course, also to break down the cultural identities of the countries themselves. And one of the models that Perlmutter developed was the global city, which would be, basically a megapolis, which was didn't have any particular heritage or identity at all. And the model for that was to be Paris, which he recommended could be denationalized by international rock festivals, for instance. We can see how modern music today is so clearly infecting, on a global basis, the cultural identities of the young. And Perlmutter, that was his model some years ago for creating global cities and geocentric companies, etc. So the global me is basically a hybrid humanity that doesn't have any roots to any particular culture or space or land.
And the next chapter is called the Jewish factor. What I like to say about this issue specifically is I've noticed among so many people out there, they tend to say this issue is the number one issue, and to the point where they downplay everything else. Like I don't mean to pick on him, but I know with someone like David Duke, for instance, he focuses exclusively on this issue, but I think some people, I mean, it is a legitimate issue, but I think some people have a tendency to get so focused on this one issue that they downplay the role that capitalism and corporations play. But
one of the things I was criticized for about Revolution from Above is that I didn't mention the Jews, but...
But you're going to mention it briefly.
Yeah, I mentioned it somewhere, very briefly, but my view when I was writing that was that if I was going to mention the Jews, I'd have to interject that factor throughout the entire book, and it would mean it was once again another book on Jews, and it's not really what I wanted to explain at the time with that book. Whereas with Babel Incorporated, once again, it's not interspersed with material on Jews, but I think that there is a certain factor there which is a wee bit separate from the global capitalists, although it intersects at certain points. But Jews or organised Jewry has its own agenda in backing multiculturalism, and I quote Izzy Liebler there of the World Jewish Congress, who served as chairman of the Australian Executive Council of Jewry, who at the time that Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party was having some success in 1993, that he said, this is a terrible thing, our heritage in Australia is multiculturalism, and we should make sure we get back to that. Whereas in terms of Israel, he specifically stated that Israel shouldn't have anything whatsoever to do with multiculturalism because it would just break the nation down. So you have this dichotomy at work, this moral duality within organised Jewry to promote multiculturalism and Gentile states while pouring it for Israel and for the Jewish people, to the point of regarding intermarriage as something horrendous amongst them. But having said that, I think that, you know, if there was no Jewish question, I mean, you'd still have the same problems in terms of globalization.
Yeah, I mean, even if you go back in history, you had Anglo-businessmen who imported Chinese labor to build the railroads. Mm. I think even if it wasn't for that group specifically, you would still see a lot of the same trends in the world.
It's natural development of capitalism. As Marx himself stated, capitalism would become internationalized. The difference is, of course, is that Marx thought that was good. He thought it was, you know, a great part of the dialectical process from where the world would move from capitalism to international capitalism to international socialism, you know, the fundamental of the whole lot being internationalization. You know, as far as capitalism goes, I mean, there's nothing particularly unique in the situation we're in. You could trace it back to the last eras of Greece and Rome and, you know, no doubt all sorts of other civilizations where the power of money developed to such an extent that the new ruling class became, the plutocracy, and the underlying ethos which established those civilizations changed fundamentally into one of money thinking. And that's just what we got today in this era of the West. We've got the same sort of plutocrats as Rome and Greece had at their, parallel eras of cultural decline. So, you know, eliminate the Jewish factor and then you still got the factor of how money and money power develops. It's no use putting the blame on Jews for everything or saying that the Jewish factor is the only factor that is controlling what's happening.
Is this the chapter where you talk about George Soros' Open Society?
I do mention George Soros' Open Society. Ironically, he doesn't seem to be a Zionist. He's one of these secular internationalists.
I don't even think... I'm not defending him. He's a really despicable person.
Yeah,
I don't
think
he's necessarily that ethnocentric. He's actually criticized Israel many times. Explain what does his organization, the Open Society, do?
Well, I explained that in quite some detail in Revolution from Above, but, it wants a global economy and a new world order, virtually. So he creates a myriad of fronts. And,
but he does it under the name of humanitarianism.
Of course, they all do.
Yeah.
The whole lot do. I mean, you know, Rockefeller does it. The Ford Foundation does it. You know, some of the complete most bastardest people in the world do it under the terms of humanity. And, America bombs Serbia in the name of humanity, and Syria, and whatever else it can destroy in the name of humanity, in the name of human rights and equality. It's just a part of this big facade of using idealism to push your own agenda. And Soros has been accused of having a messiah complex. I mean, he meets with his other kin, the Rockefellers and Rothschilds and, all these other wealthy people, basically to redesign the world in their own image. And, of course, the Open Society has created a huge number of fronts under all sorts of different names throughout the entire world, all to push the idea of the world as one, and, nationhood as a hindrance to human progress. So it'll be, seen to be breaking down traditional attitudes towards abortion, for instance, or promoting marijuana liberalization, basically undermining...
What's so bad about marijuana?
Are you serious?
I don't have a problem with it.
Okay, well, it strikes me as, one more of these liberal trends that has been pushed to break down, the psyche of people and redirect them. I mean, to me, it reminds me of Soma and Julius Huxley's Brave New World.
I'm actually someone who I mean, I'm personally pro-marijuana, but I was talking, joking about that with a friend, that the government is sort of caving into drug legalization so we can all, like, be, everyone will be happy and drugged out and not care, sort of like Soma. And I'm saying that even though I personally like marijuana.
Right, okay.
But I
okay.
think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think, as you said, it just reminds me of the Soma narcoticized, you know, mentality. You know, you get people on Cyrus's board advocating marijuana legalization, people like Paul Volcker and, you know, the high
power. The other side of it is there's bankers invested in the prison industrial complex who have a vested interest in keeping the war on drugs.
Well, that could be quite true. I mean, things operate on a dialectical process. I suppose it depends where you stand on, you know, broader issues, and it's just a matter of perspective. I guess, you know, maybe in an older generation that is a bit conservative in certain things and sees it all part of the sort of 60s generation that... you know, was heralded as something wonderful, whereas it was basically drugged up and didn't really achieve anything. You know, I certainly wouldn't be opposed to it for medical reasons and, you know, such what.
And the next chapter is a cultural imperialism, and obviously cultural imperialism is pretty obvious. It's exporting things like pop culture and consumerism and things like fast food to other parts of the world to destroy their culture, and that is actually something even people on the left they do talk about cultural imperialism to a degree. People like Noam Chomsky.
Yes, that's correct. Indeed, you know, cultural imperialism was you know, very much an issue of the left. But I mean, as you know, the French New Right says, you can't really talk against these things if you still talk in terms of multiculturalism and, you know, immigration. And
a lot of people on the right. There's people on the right who are opposed to third world immigration, but they're also apologists for American cultural imperialism in other parts of the world.
Yeah, it seems to be a hangover from a Cold War, basically,
yeah.
Where you know, the world was seen as divided between good and evil. America leading, you know, the good, and you know, we've since had in more recent times statements by people like the strategist Rolf Peters, you know, who was a quite a influential strategist for the U.S. government and military, starting in 1997 in Perimeters, you know, a journal of the military. He referred to what he called constant conflict as a means of destroying, you know, the so-called rejectionist states. And he said that, you know, things like MTV and Madonna and, you know, burgers are the most lethal weapon of undermining a nation.
Yeah, it reminds me, recently Netanyahu actually said people in Iran are not free unless they have blue jeans.
Right, well, that says it all, really. Yeah, that says it all. And, you know, now... with this cultural imperialism, we've got a whole new genre of hip-hop, and these musical fashions in particular seem to be particularly avidly embraced by the United States. You know, and now hip-hop has become, well, Hillary Clinton referred to it, to hip-hop as America, or America as hip-hop. So, apparently, America is now to be defined as the hip-hop nation, which exports that subculture to the entire world as a means of once again breaking down local ethnic cultures amongst youth. So now you have the U.S. State Department, you know, funding all sorts of hip-hop festivals throughout the world, and you know, U.S. official has made remarks. So I think Hillary Clinton was commenting that if they can get hip hop into Syria, you know, the entire scenario will change, and you know, it will be a victory for the United States. And you know, in Morocco, for instance, they held a hip hop festival, which they called Hip Hop Diplomacy, funded by the United States in 2005. and something called Audio Pharmacy is a group that travels the world on US State Department funding to introduce all this wonderful stuff to the youth all over the world.
Yeah, and I think with like the Muslim underclass in Europe, I think they would rather see them adopt this sort of adopt like the American black ghetto culture than a strong Islamic identity. And not saying I don't necessarily want Islamists in Europe, but I am saying that I think they want them to adopt. Would they'd rather see them adopt sort of the American black ghetto culture than
exactly
be Islamic? Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, the US has sponsored fringe hip-hop groups to America, and they've come back saying how impressed they were by the American dream, etc. So, you know, we're taught to think that hip-hop and such genres are, you know, something new and radical, like the bloody, you know, 1960s crap supposed to be new and radical. But once again, it's just another means of the corporates and the internationalists controlling youth in their desired direction. You know, and one of the focuses I have in the book is on Charles Rivkin, who was until recently the US ambassador to France. And in 2010, he's starting to, he issued a memo on how America could change France. I mean, talking about fundamental changes of the French and destroying their sense of history and culture. You know, and he's referring to terms of an aggressive youth outreach and how 1,000 US English language teachers in France could be used as, you know, the means of changing the French. And you've got things like a program called Black Paris, run by someone called Monique Wills, funded by, you know, and supported by the US State Department, and multicultural murals and murals of Martin Luther King, etc., funded by the US State Department in France. And so we've got something that seems to be quite reminiscent of what the United States did during the Cold War era, when they purveyed abstract expressionism and jazz, etc., as the American culture to embrace the entire world. And the idea of that was to undermine the Soviet Union by showing how wonderfully free and hip that the United States is if you would just embrace the American dream. And of course the Soviet Union recognized this as a deliberate strategy, which we now know it was, and was spearheaded by the Congress for Cultural Freedom, etc., which we now seem to be having the same situation in terms of these newer musical and cultural genres.
And that, what you mentioned, that's from the chapter Target France.
Yeah. And France certainly does seem to be the target, I suppose, because France seems to be one of the few nations which still has quite a pride in their ethnicity and tradition. So it seems to be, you know, without actually being a rejectionist state, still seems to be regarded as a xenophobic people who need changing, and maybe France is, you know, basically an experiment on how a nation and the people can be changed into globalists from being, proud of their heritage. Because it certainly seems that everything's pouring into France.
One thing about Generation Identity in France, they focus on Americanization as much as Islamization, because I know you have the anti-jihad movement in Europe. Is they're focused purely on Islam.
And in England, you saw the English Defence League going about with Israeli flags, and of course. Breivik was it Norway, he was ever the pro-Zionist and pro-Israel. But having said that, I think the Zionists are quite nervous about the resurgence of a right, even if it's pro-Zionist. And we get, statements by Zionist spokesmen reminding Jews that even though, they might regard Islam as a threat in Europe, it might not be such a good idea for Jews to back right-wing movements, such as,
it has happened. There have, I mean,
yeah.
the, the majority of Jews in Europe don't support nationalism, but there have been some, because there was basically happening as they're getting attacked by Muslims in the streets.
Yeah. So you know, sort of, once again, they're placing themselves in a very awkward position. So God knows how that went.
And I guess we can get back to the chapter about it. There's a chapter on wars in the name of multiculturalism.
Right.
But I think we should talk about the de-Europeanization of Europe, because it ties in with what we're talking about right now.
Sorry, I missed that.
The de-Europeanization of Europe. What we're talking about that now, but what are some other things you get into detail about in that chapter?
I'm still missing what you said. Are you able to edit this, all right?
Yeah, I can.
What chapter is it? There's one word isn't coming out clearly. De-Europeanization. Now I've got it. Yes.
Yeah, you got it. Okay.
Yeah. Well, the de-Europeanization of Europe is basically for the purposes of creating a world state, you know, simply by drawing on, you know, political ideologies such as the French Revolution. And, I mean, France is in an awkward position in that modern France is basically founded upon French revolutionary ideas, you know, and of liberty, equality, fraternity, and that's something that Charles Rivkin said that the US should focus on to, you know, undermine the French by turning their own ideology back on them. And it seems rather bizarre to me that, you know, you get the French right singing the Marseillaise and, you know, giving loyalty to ideas and ideologies that are fundamentally anti-tradition and anti-right. So, you know, some of these states in Europe are really flawed, like the US itself, which is based on, you know, deistic and rationalistic ideas. So we have to return to, I think, pre, you know, 1789 ideas of tradition, something in terms of what Julius Evola was talking about. Not that I'm a, you know, great Evola fan, but I think we took a wrong turning point from at least 1789 onwards, because much of our modern day thinking is actually infected by those ideas.
And the chapter we can go back to is the one, Wars in the Name of Multiculturalism. I think probably the most obvious example would be Serbia.
Yes,
but even the wars in the Middle East tie in as well.
Yeah, well, I focus on Serbia. People like Wesley Clark were stating that, you know, Serbia is an anachronism in the modern world. It's a, you know, an ethnic state, and the world is not going to be tolerant of ethnic states. But once again, we see how multiculturalism has been used as a pretext for destroying a so-called rejectionist state for the purposes of taking over the economy. I think the Kosovan Albanians were in a similar situation to the Uitlanders in the South African Boer Republics. You know, the Uitlanders were using as an excuse to invade the Afrikaner Republics, supposedly to ensure their rights, their democratic rights, just as in Serbia, that state was, you know, attacked to supposedly ensure the democratic rights of the Kosovo Albanians. You know, the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Front, was until that time listed by the U.S. State Department as a terrorist organization and a criminal, you know, gang of heroin runners, basically. But it suddenly became freedom fighters. And it's notable, I think, that the agreement of Rambouillet, which was the basis of any peaceful settlement with the Serbs, in which the Serbs refused to sign, was once again like the, you know, the Atlantic Charter and the 14 points, based around free trade. And what they demanded is that the Serbs privatise their economy. which until that time I think was based really on worker cooperatives and profit sharing. And, you know, once the Serbs were bombed into submission, an agency for privatisation was created in Serbia, in Kosovo, for the specific purpose of privatising the Kosovan enterprises. And the crown and the jewel there was the Kretka mining region, which since ancient Roman times has, you know, been used as a mine for lead, zinc, gold, silver, and magnesium. And, you know, that was the great aim to capture these resources. But unfortunately, Kosovo was so destroyed by the, you know, by NATO bombing, etc., that the economy still in the shambles, and getting buyers for the privatised enterprises has actually been quite difficult. So, you know, that was, you know, like, I suppose you could say, like, you know, the war against Germany and the war against maybe even Napoleon and others, you know, was done in the pretext of human rights, but the real prize was the human, tremendous resources to be had.
Do you say anything in that chapter about the, any of the wars in the Middle East or the current the situation currently in Syria?
Well, the situation in the Middle East is really the same, and you know, the chart plotted, the course plotted for Syria and North Africa was charted, you know, maybe a decade or so ago by the Project for a New American Century and others, you know, other neocon organisations, which basically said that they'd sweep all these so-called rejectionist states from the scene, and that's what we've seen happening one by one, you know. I mostly deal with that and revolution from above, but certainly the Muslims have been placed in a situation where, you know, on the one hand, the new threat, you know, that has replaced the so-called Soviet threat, but on the other hand, be used where, you know, where necessary for globalist purposes, like, you know, in Afghanistan, the Islamics, the Islamists were backed by the US against the Soviet Union, and yet the same organisations are now regarded as terrorists, and they use as a pretext for, you know, getting the US and the global corporations into the Middle East. So the Islam seems to be the victim of a dialectical process where they're being used one way or the other, and they seem to be placed in an impossible situation. You know, and I think if we look at it in a bit of a detached manner, we can see the whole situation going back to the way the Arabs were betrayed during World War One. You know, being promised independence from France and Britain on one hand, and then you know, being sold out in the you know, behind the back door of diplomacy on the other. So I think they're really quite a tragic victim, and you know, I'm a bit dubious about opposition to Islam and as the, so, you know, the new form of anti-Sovietism, Cold War style, which also served globalisation, and, you know, the right took a wrong turn there as well, I think.
And the last chapter, well, there's a conclusion, but I guess the last main chapter is purse strings. What do you mean by purse strings?
Well, you know, we sort of discussed it somewhat previously in regards to the way the various ethnic lobbies are financed by the global corporations, and I give specific examples of that.
MALDEF.
Yeah, all those, and, you know,
and so-called anti-racist groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center or Searchlight in the UK.
Yeah, I don't actually go into those, unfortunately, but that's certainly a, you know, something that could be quite easily looked into. I mean, all these organisations have their foundation support, and you know, there's so many corporations and foundations that pour millions and millions of dollars into all sorts of ethnic lobbies. I mostly treat the United States situation in terms of the blacks and the Latinos, you know, the RASA, you know, the Council for the RASA and MALDEF, and there's all sorts of Hispanic alliances, you know, which are heavily funded by Walmart and, you know, Morgans and Rothschilds and Rockefellers, you know. It just follows the same procedure of how the corporates have backed liberal left organisations. It's when you start researching it, it's virtually an endless web, and eventually you have to say, "I'll stop here, otherwise I'll spend the rest of my life, you know, tracking one link to the other." So I highlight organisations such as MALDEF, the NAACP, and the National Council for the RASA, which has a lot of Rockefeller and Ford Foundation funding.
Before I wrap things up, is there anything else about the book you'd like to add?
My view is that it provides a very cogent summary of the forces we're up against, and why multiculturalism is being used. It can be used as an argument to bypass or counter the left, which hurls the accusation of racism and inhumanity in your face whenever issues such as immigration are involved. And this book explains that, you know, it's not a matter of inhumanity at all. It's a matter of the way that multiculturalism is being cynically used, and the way the left itself has been cynically used by forces that, you know, these people really don't understand.
Kerry Bolden, I'd like to thank you for being on.
Thank you very much indeed.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.